When my fourth baby was just a few weeks old and started making a sometimes grunty and sometimes squeaky noise with each inhale, I didn't know what to think, and I certainly didn't expect the diagnosis that she would ultimately get. Laryngomalacia is a term that we all became intimately familiar with, and it basically translates to mean soft or floppy vocal cords. In this episode, I take you through all of the information that you need to know about laryngomalacia, from the physiology to the symptoms to the levels of severity and then treatment. I detail everything I can remember from that time and also how it affected my daughter's sleeping, feeding, and thus weight gain significantly. If you're listening to this episode, it might be because you're going through it. And for that, I give you a big hug. So let's get going.
Welcome to Healthy as a Mother, the podcast for becoming and being a mother, with your co-hosts, Dr. Leah Gordon and Dr. Morgan McDermott, two naturopathic doctors who get it.
Each week, we teach you how to be the healthiest mother you can be, from fertility and preconception to pregnancy and birth prep, through postpartum and throughout motherhood, empowering you with the natural health guidance and education you're not getting elsewhere, so you can confidently navigate the broken system at large.
The real, the raw, the untalked about. And remember, this information is not intended to diagnose, treat, or manage any disease. Always consult with your doctor before making any changes.
Growing a baby, healing postpartum, making milk, your body's mineral needs are off the chart during these times. And that's why Dr. Leah and I swear by Relight by Redmond, the real salt people, an electrolyte powder packed with USA mined unrefined sea salt and essential minerals like magnesium, calcium, and potassium. Unlike many popular electrolyte companies, Redmond is the only company who is completely transparent about their sodium source because they own and operate the mine. It's clean, delicious, and the perfect thing for labor, breastfeeding, and thriving in mom life. So go ahead and grab a sample pack to try all of the flavors or hand your trust over to me and start with strawberry lemonade. Go to redmond.life and use code HEALTHYMOTHER for 15% off. Hydration handled.
Okay, today on the podcast, Dr. Morgan is bringing her wisdom and knowledge on laryngomalacia, which sounds really crazy and weird, but you'll tell us all about it and what it is and your experience with it with your – is it Sunny the only one that had it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so with your fourth child, Sunday. So why don't we kick off and you just tell us what that long, complicated word means.
Totally. So this is kind of a backtracking episode, but I have been asked so many times online. I think that there's just not that much information about laryngomalacia out there. Some people call it laryngomalacia. I don't say that. I say laryngo. So basically, laryng means for the larynx and malacia means soft. So in other words and medical terms, you'll see that malacia in association with whatever the other first word is going to mean soft or sometimes misshapen. So in this, in laryngomalacia, we're talking about a larynx that is soft and misshapen. And so the reason why this is relevant, and for anybody who's listening who maybe has a baby going through it, this, my fourth, Sunday, was born, and she was like, you know, a little bit noisy as a newborn can be, but typically symptoms don't really start until somewhere between like 10 and 14 days. So those early newborn sounds don't necessarily mean anything. There's also lots of different levels of laryngomalacia, which we're going to talk about. So I'm going to kind of blend some general information about it along with our experience, just so that you don't feel as alone, because I think I was the only person I've ever heard of who, I mean, I didn't know anybody who had a child with laryngomalacia. So I was really learning as we went. And it's basically just a very annoying and disruptive condition that affects feeding mostly, but also sleeping in your baby that luckily most of the time does not have any other harmful side effects and they grow out of it. So like 95% of kids will grow out of their laryngomalacia symptoms by age 2. Now, that does mean that like there will be some that have continued symptoms, and probably for Sunday, she still makes some of the sounds even now at 18 months. So I'm assuming that at 2 years, she probably will still make the sounds a little bit, but I don't think that it affects her on a day-to-day basis at all after maybe like her being like 9 months or 10 months. But prior to that, it was a very difficult time for us, and I will explain why. Incoming. But let me just talk about laryngomalacia so that people are like, well, you know, what the heck is this? What's going on? Yeah. So it's basically that the larynx, which is your voice box, has all these different connective tissue structures that are sort of layering on top of each other. And there's this thing called the epiglottal arch, or it, you can call it like the epiglottis, but there's an arch shape to it that's supposed to be held firm in this particular shape in like a normal larynx. And in the case of kids with laryngeal malacia, which is just, it's a birth defect. So they're born with it. It's not like somebody can develop this later on in life. And it is something that like will correct in time. It's like a very weak, soft, floppy epiglottal arch. So it's shaped more like the Greek letter omega, where it's like flat line, like flat horizontal line, and then like big bubble up and then flat horizontal line. You know, if you think about like Greek, I don't know, like in college or something, your sororities and fraternities. Oh my God, I'm so glad that I was never a part of that. Anyways, I know. We had a really great college experience, though.
We really did.
Without any of that.
We had the Slant Shack sorority. That was just us.
Which the Slant Shack was our house that we lived in college was called the Slant Shack because it literally tilted to one side. My dad is an architect, and when he was moving us into the house, he was not pleased that that was the house that we were choosing to live on because the bottom floor was shifted off to one direction and the top floor was shifted off the other direction. So it like stayed balanced, but there's no way. Like if there was an earthquake, that house is going down.
Oh, 100%. So, if there was just like a lot of rain, I feel like it would have just sogged down. I don't know. For anyone who doesn't know, I know this is about laryngeal malacia, but Morgan and I went to undergrad and medical school together. So that we're talking about undergrad when we were just, you know, living the good life, saving money. I remember my room was like $400.
Yes.
In that house, which, you know, then
which was actually a lot at that time.
I know, because we lived right by campus. We were in a really cool house. We'd have really fun dress up parties. But
anyways, yeah, it was really fun. That the Slant Shack still stands. It's still a thing. I cannot believe
that is the case. But anyways,
I was on the upper floor along with you, and it was like wooden, really crappy wooden board flooring that was like, you know, 400 years old.
Literally.
I remember my desk, and I had a rolling sliding chair. And if I wanted to like cross both my legs and sit at my desk and like study, I would just slide off to the side of the room. Like I had to have one foot planted on the ground. Ooh, I'm going to sneeze. Excuse me.
Bless you.
Because it was that slanted. Like it was really bad, you guys. Not level at all. Anyways. Okay. So the Greek letter omega is what I was getting back to about laryngeal malacia here. So the symptom that you're mostly going to notice that's going to make you think there's something going on with my baby, what is this, is that on their inhalation, so when they're taking their little fast, rapid newborn breaths, there is a sound that's wheezy sort of, and it's very high-pitched, it's squeaky, it's grunty, sometimes it's like a goose honking, sometimes it's just, there's a range of sounds, but it's called stridor, so S-T-R-I-D-O-R, stridor. So this is called inhalation stridor because it's only on the inhalation. Now, if your baby also has exhalation sounds that are happening, that could be something now called bronchomalacia. If your baby has laryngeal malacia and bronchomalacia, it's usually a much more severe case. And sometimes these are the situations where like they need to go on to have surgery or just be more monitored because of things like sleep apnea and cyanosis. So we're going to talk about that in a little bit. But with laryngeal malacia, which is far more common than bronchomalacia, thank goodness, it's on the inhale. So they're like, or like, like Sunny sounded like a goose sometimes, like a honking goose.
Okay. And you're saying that this is not common. And my son also was born with this. And I have another friend here in the Valley whose son was born with this. They called him Goose because he sounded like a honking goose. So I actually think it might be more common. Maybe it's something environmental, or maybe it's here. Maybe it's the fires here. I don't know. But it might actually be more common and people just don't know about it because it's not causing enough problems that they would have ever pursued anything. But yeah, that honking goose sound. I mean, Cade had that. He grew out of it, but he had that for a while.
Wow. And see, he already grew out of it. Like he doesn't do it at all anymore. Mm-mm.
I don't hear it at all, but he did for the first like 3 months.
Okay. See, and that would be more typical. So that's considered a mild case of laryngeal malacia. And I always have told people that I thought that Sunny didn't qualify for the severe case of laryngeal malacia. Maybe from like the one resource that I had read at that time, that was the delineating factor, but I just was looking it up in you know, preparation for this episode, and she actually does have severe, or she had severe. So the highest form of it, except she did still have the absence of turning blue. So like not getting enough oxygen, thank goodness, because that would be extremely terrifying. But anyways, so there's probably actually a lot of more parents, like you're saying, that notice it, or they only notice it at certain times. So it's worse when the infant is laying on their back, when they're feeding, when they're crying, or when they're excited. Like anything that's going to make them breathe faster or have sort of like a different breathing pattern. And so where feeding comes into play is that they're supposed to be doing this suck, swallow, breathe, suck, swallow, breathe, suck, swallow, breathe. Whether that's at the breast or on a bottle, it's the same thing. So when they are doing that breathing, that's when you're going to hear it. It's like, and so a lot of women will just only hear it when they're nursing or feeding their babies, and then they don't really think anything of it because they're just like, well, I mean, whatever. And then it stops. It goes away. It doesn't seem to affect anything. So rah, 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 whatever. But in the situation where they are affected, and I'll talk about what would that actually look like, maybe we're in the setting of moderate or severe laryngeal malacia. So the causes, if everybody always wants to know, like, well, what is it that's causing this? And are there any other connections with anything else? So first of all, it's caused by, well, there's a couple of options, but mostly we don't really know. And we just think that it's weak tissue for some reason, and that there is like a weakening of this connective tissue piece that didn't form the rigid arch that it's meant to. There is also a connection with lip and tongue ties, because if in utero, you imagine a baby that has fascial tissue too tight of the frenum underneath their tongue that is holding the tongue down to the bottom of the mouth, and it's not suctioned to the roof of the mouth and doing the undulation motion, which is in practice for nursing that it should be doing, all of that connective tissue down the whole back of the throat and into the larynx is also then now not being toned. If it's not moving, the tongue is not suctioned to the roof of the mouth and doing this undulation and stuff like that in the frequency of which we would want it to, because it literally can't move, or maybe it's lax and loose and has no tone itself, the tongue, then it's going to affect everything. You know, tongue and lip ties do affect the entire body. The fascial chains are all connected down to the tips of your toes. So it's like not just a small thing. If there's a connection there, it does not mean that if your baby has laryngeal malacia that they do have a tongue tie, but there is often situations though where people go, oh my gosh, like this baby was tied and this baby has laryngeal malacia. Like, so interesting. So there is some theory that potentially there's a cause of laryngeal malacia, which might come from like a delayed neuromuscular development sense. I mean, it does make logical sense, but you would also probably see in those cases, those children have other muscular, you know, things going on. In my case, we didn't see that with Sunday. Or a neurological component. So maybe there's like a neurological dysfunction or immaturity. Again, that wasn't the case for us, but like, I don't know. I mean, I'm sure that can be something. Really, it seems as though the medical community at large still doesn't really know yet. And I agree with you. It does feel like, I don't know if it's just because it's on my radar now because of my experience, but I do hear about it all the time now.
Yeah. I wonder if there's something environmental. Because I didn't have it with Avia, obviously. I lived in a different place. I don't know. It's just interesting that I moved to Idaho and then you have it. I have it. My friend Nikki had it. I'm like, what is going on? It could be totally just random. Or maybe post-COVID. I mean, I don't know. Everything in the post-COVID world is different.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, I guess hopefully time will tell at some point. Also, just more information about tongue lip ties in general, because that is so
– yeah.
It's such a flabbergasting thing to me. But okay, so the symptoms, like I mentioned, would mostly be this sound. This is like the key thing. It's going to tip you off. If your baby does not have this sound, then they do not have laryngeal malacia. Like, it's just, you're just not going to, that it's because every time they take an inhale, instead of that tissue holding the arch open for the airway, it's collapsing. So now there is partial airway obstruction. So people are like, oh my God, is my baby going to die? The chances of them having something where they're not going to be able to get enough oxygen and have some sort of like very traumatic negative event are very rare. But again, like I was saying, there is certain situations where maybe it is very severe for some reason, or in combination with bronchomalacia, this is where maybe surgery does have a place. And we'll get to the treatments in a second. But also what you might notice if you have the stridor sounds in your baby is that they have feeding challenges. So they may have a really hard time maintaining that pattern, suck, swallow, breathe, suck, swallow, breathe. And what would happen with Sunday is she would latch, she'd start drinking, and then my milk would come, like I'd have a letdown, and she would go, suck, swallow, breathe, suck, swallow, breathe, suck, swallow, breathe, 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 breathe. Like her epiglottal arch, I'm assuming, you know, it kind of would like catch, it would sort of collapse, and then she would like try to be inhaling and regulating her breathing rhythm. And instead, she would just swallow a ton of air and choke and gag and pop off. And it was horrible because then it really contributed to tons and tons and tons of reflux and spit up and weight gain problems. And so it's really common for these kids to have reflux of some kind, whether it's happy spitting reflux, meaning like they're not colicky, they don't seem to be upset by it, it doesn't seem to be causing problems, which was mostly the case for Sunday, like 98% of it for her. Luckily, she was just like totally fine. And she'd just look at me and like vomit up the entire feed. And I was like, cool. But also they can have failure to thrive. So because they are so slow at weight gain, because so much of their food, whether it's a bottle or at the breast, is coming up and literally just not able to stay down in their body. And then the other one that's the scarier ones that we don't want to see that are maybe that would shunt us again into that surgery category, into the severe category, are apnea. So like where we stop breathing at night when we're sleeping, or cyanosis in general. So if you're becoming cyanotic, it means that you're not getting enough oxygen. So usually in little babies, what that would mean is like they get dusky, like a dusky bluish color around their lips and their mouth is kind of like the easiest way to tell. If you had some sort of like pulse oximeter, I guess you would probably see it. And it's usually in moments. It's not like all the time chronically, they're not getting enough oxygen. It would just be maybe in a situation like where they were excited, they were worked up, they were crying, they were on their back. And then you look at them and you're like, wait a minute, like what's going on? Because it's easier for that airway to become compromised and to become partially obstructed.
Mm-hmm. As a side, I had a friend tell me about something called an owlet, which you can put on the foot and see. In a case like this, would you recommend a parent do something like that? An owlet, I think, is a device that alerts you to low oxygen.
Yes, it does. I think it would be a good idea if that was part of your case. And I considered it, but because she never had a moment of cyanosis, she never had a moment of apnea that I was aware of, at least. So I know we've kind of talked about this in the past, but I was cleared by her pediatrician and also encouraged in this case with an airway issue to consider the idea of belly sleep. I was already belly sleeping her prior to that suggestion because of she literally would not sleep on her back. And my other two girls had slept on their bellies from day one, which I was very comfortable with. I know that that is against medical advice in most settings with the American Academy of Pediatrics, but there are going to be cases where they do overrule that and they supersede it because of potential airway issues like this. And when the baby is facing down, the airway falls open in a more beneficial way for airflow than if they are on their back.
And if your baby's spitting up that much, I would think that that's a hazard to sleep them on their back.
Yeah, that's a good point too. That wasn't part of the largest
thing with drunk people is that you don't let them fall asleep on their back, because if they throw up, they can choke on their vomit and die. And if a baby's spitting up all the time, it doesn't make sense to me that sleeping them on their back with their arms pinned to their side is the safest.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of questions that we could ask.
Yeah, that. For sure. A whole other conversation for another podcast.
Like yes. And actually, you're reminding me too that I forgot about this, that the little bassinet that I gave you, I don't know if you ever use this for him, but you can like click it up on one side more.
Oh, I didn't know.
I don't know
that.
If I ever told you that. Sorry if I didn't.
Time has passed. Tell Ilana because I gave it to her.
Okay, I'll tell Ilana. But her bassinet could rise up and down because it was like a co-sleeper so that it could be at the level of your bed. But then, you know, you could just preferentially put one of the sides up a little higher. So it was elevated. And we did, and you do have to do some different things. You have to get cleared and blah, 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 blah. So this is not telling you that you need to do this, but look into it, ask your doctor, etc. We did try that. And I do think it kind of helped for her for sleeping sometimes. Not as much. Basically though, like really long story short, upon all of the efforts I'm going to tell you that I tried with Sunday, nothing really helped all that much. And I think I was just on a like rampage of fleshing out all of the options that felt important to me. And I had to at some point come to the moment of going, I'm going to try like these four more things. And beyond that, I'm just going to like survive. And I know that eventually this is going to be done, because it was really, really trying and really hard, because she was not gaining weight. One time I was in a lactation appointment and we did a weighted feed. So like we weighed her, I fed her, we weighed her again to see how many ounces of milk she took in. Let's just pretend, I think it was like 3 ounces that she took in. Very classic, very normal. Now, this lactation consultant also does a craniosacral therapy. So we were there for that, for her mouth. So Sunday was lip and tongue tied. Big surprise there. All my kids are. We had her revised at 3 days. So prior to us even knowing about her laryngeal malacia, we did not know about it until more like 10 days. So we had her revised at 3 days, or released is the proper term. And that's sort of a necessity of all of our kids. I can't nurse them unless they have it because their mouths are so bad. They just mess my nipples up so badly. They don't get to intake milk. They don't gain weight. They don't thrive. They would be like true failure to thrive cases without that. So that was like, you know, status quo. So then we're getting her lots of body work after the procedure, as all of my kids receive. So this was normal for me to be at the craniosacral therapy office anyways, and we were hoping that it would help. One of the things that Sunday also had that I feel like a lot of kids in this category will have is very just low oral tone in general. That means that like her tongue, her lips, her cheek, everything was just like weak and open, and she just always had this like – she still has it, this like open mouth posture. And her tongue is down and her lips are like just juicy, loosey, goosey, just like drooling, you know, and her cheeks are fat and not, there's no tone or turgor to them. Like none of the oral factory of the mouth and in the way that it needs to move and work was optimal for her. It was all on the like negative side of things. So that doesn't help obviously with any of this. So I was in a lot of craniosacral therapy and doing suck retraining exercises, which is already part of a lot of the tongue and lip tie release protocol anyway. But specifically for her, we needed to get her strengthened. So I was doing exercises around the clock. It was so like just difficult to fit it in having three other children. And it also kind of felt like it didn't really help all that much. I mean, maybe it did a little bit. It's hard to tell. I think overall though, all of my therapies combined probably helped her maybe maximum 20%. It was very low. And I don't say this to be like downy on anyone. I say it to just be real. Like I had much higher hopes for everything I tried. And I thought it was, I mean, who knows? I don't have a crystal ball, but it was just time. We just had to wait till she got stronger and that arch solidified. And the lactation consultant was doing craniosacral therapy on her and she was spitting up like a totally normal amount. Like it was just a normal thing. So then she was like, wow, this is a lot. I'm like, yeah, that's normal for her. She's like, let's weigh her again. She had spit up 1.5 ounces of the 3 ounces that she took in. And that was totally normal. So I was like, okay, so she's spitting up half of what she's intaking every single time. So her weight growth curve was extremely slow. She did not double her weight at 5 months like a breastfed baby should. And that was really, really stressful for me. Like she's perfect and fine and everything is fine, but it was just like this thing where I was feeding her around the clock for her to just turn around and spit it all up. And it's like, so oh my gosh. Oh, I did figure out actually though, because then I went down the whole path of, well, is there something in my milk that's causing her to spit up? And actually, she really did react worse when I ate eggs. So if I took out eggs, she spit up a bit less. So that is one thing. That was probably one of the most significant things actually for her spitting up that helped was me figuring that out. And it took a lot of trial and error. First, I took out gluten. Then I took out dairy. Then I took out, you know, and I put them back in. There was no change. Like whatever. And if you take out a food, if you're trying to figure out a breast milk food protein allergy for your baby, if you take it out for just even a couple of days, there should be some level of improvement. This idea that we have to take it out for like 90 days before we see anything, like no, that is not true. A resource that I really love is the Instagram account Free to Feed. I'll write that down, Free to Feed, and they do consults. So if you are considering that there's an issue for your baby in the milk, you can have a consult with them. And I did, and she helped me learn and realize that because Sunday had an absence of skin anomalies, she had no eczema, she had no rashes, nothing else was going on in that kind of way. It made the doctor tell me that it's very unlikely that she has like an actual allergy that's happening. Maybe she has some kind of an intolerance, but it's not going to be like a huge deal. I did discover that the eggs made her spit up more, but it wasn't like a systemic problem for her body. I think it was just more of one of those like, bleh, you know, yeah, now we're going to spit up more kind of things. Anyway, so for us, it was more of like a weight gain and feeding chaos that was really stressful. Like every time I would feed her, it was just, I was covered in milk. She would like choke and gag. The feeding sessions took very, very long. And I have a fast letdown. So I was doing all sorts of different things. I was like letting down into like a haka so that it wasn't as hard for her. But then her mouth was so weak that she couldn't latch and then suck out the milk properly. So then I would have to give her the milk and then blah, blah, blah. And then I would lay back on my back so that the letdown wasn't as good. And it just like, I was constantly trying to figure out a way to just get to a place where it felt easy. And my own mental, emotional mind had to really shift. And that's what I was saying. Like when I got to the point of just being okay with what was happening, like acceptance, then I think I had a better time as a mom because I really had to just surrender to this. Like there was not going to be much of anything that I could do. And then I started to like really pump my days full of joy. So I had like this very specific goal. Every day I would do at least one thing that brought me joy. And this is when we started reading those books.
Yeah.
It all comes back to the fantasy books. But I remember she was like 8 weeks old. And I was like, I'm like, and it's winter and the sun's never out. And maybe she was even a little younger. Maybe she was like 5 weeks, 4 weeks. And I kept seeing Fourth Wing on everything. Like it was trending so hard. And I was just like, you know what? I haven't read a book that's not been about some medical something for 10 years. Like I'm going to try this. And it was magical and amazing. And now I'm never going to stop. Okay.
I love it. I was like, it's not a vice. It's a hobby. It's like so good. I 100%.
It did. It kind of took me away. It sort of distracted me. It was just mentally intriguing. And it did bring me probably some dopamine hits and different things. And I would get in the bath and I just needed like one part of my day to not feel so hard because I don't like postpartum anyways. Like even if my baby was perfect, like no problems with feeding, no problems with nursing, I don't love that hormone shift. It does not feel good in my body. It's hard for me. Yeah. So, you know, on top of everything, it was like not great. So anyway, real quick, I want to just continue kind of like chugging along some of this information. The diagnosis of laryngeal malacia is mostly clinical, meaning that like you'll take them to your doctor or your lactation consultant. Often those are the ones that are diagnosing it because it's happening during feeding in those mild cases, which is the vast majority of them. So they would just go, oh, yep, they'd listen with a stethoscope and figure out is the noise coming from an inhalation or an exhalation and get a really good assessment on that. And that's pretty much it. Now, if you want to go further because maybe it's more severe and you're trying to suss out, do we need to do something like surgery, you can get a laryngoscopy. So they would just go to an ENT and get a little scope down the back of the throat and look and see what's happening because there is different shape options. Mostly it's that omega shape. But they can assess the percentage of blockage of the airway. Like, are we worried about actual oxygen levels? You know, those kinds of things. Maybe if we did suspect bronchomalacia or it was unclear, then you would go on to get a bronchoscopy. So that's now going deeper into the lungs to assess. If we think that maybe there's something happening with aspiration, which is where you would like inhale milk. I mean, for this age, it's not going to be food. It would just be milk where they're inhaling that into their lungs, which causes problems. Then you can do something called a barium swallow study. So they basically like give your baby milk that has this radioactive chemical in it. Doesn't sound very
yummy.
And then they can see on an imaging, they watch them swallow while they're imaging it. And then they can see where the liquid is going. Is any of it going up like into the lungs? Is it going up the nose? It should just be going back and down, et cetera. So that's kind of like a further along disease level or disease process, or usually there's something else going on. Like maybe in a child that has like cerebral palsy and there's other levels of risk with like the neuromuscular system not working well. Okay. So as I was mentioning about there's mild, moderate, and severe laryngeal malacia. So mild laryngeal malacia is going to be the vast majority of them. And that's basically just like noisy breathing, but it doesn't cause any other problems. They don't have problems with weight gain. They don't have reflux problems that are causing the baby to be like unhappy or again, losing weight, something like that. Some spit up is normal with infants. Like that's okay. It's going to be like huge amounts. Like I was having to change my clothes multiple times a day. Like there was spit up on my shoes. There was spit up on the floor that had dried that I didn't even see. There was like the carpet in our living room. We always meant to replace it. We really should. It's so gross. It's like the most amazing pattern because you can't see anything. You can't see any dirt.
Great.
It's great. But it is that thing, the amount of spit up when she started like being on tummy time and stuff Like it was crazy. So anyway, that is like more on the severe end of things, obviously. But so moderate laryngeal malacia would be where you'd have like the noisy breathing plus some level of feeding difficulty and or mild reflux. But then now severe laryngeal malacia is going to be where it's like you're definitely noticing the breathing. Like that's going to be there for all cases. But then now we're having poor weight gain. Maybe we're also having sleep apnea or cyanotic events. And then we're having a significant amount of either GERD or reflux. GERD is like a more intense level of reflux. Looking at it in that light, Sunday had severe. And the lactation consultant, craniosacral therapist, who I was mentioning beforehand, has been doing this for many, many years. And she said that Sunday's case was the second worst that she'd ever seen in her entire life. Wow. So I was like, okay, well, I mean, it was at least validating. And she said, it usually gets worse before it gets better. So babies are normally diagnosed around like 2 weeks old. And she finds in most cases that it peaks around like 4 months old, 3 months old, something like that. And then it kind of goes down from there.
I mean, I feel like, I don't know if Cade would have been considered that, but when he had the noisy breathing and he had reflux, you know, remember?
So, and like all of his like arching. Mild. Yeah. His reflux was like not, it never came out of his mouth though, right? It was like,
oh yeah,
the silent reflux.
I mean, he had both, but he would spit up. Not as much as Sunny, but definitely he would spit up.
So maybe he's more moderate, but he didn't have weight gain issues. So he
didn't have weight gain issues, no. But it's like the amount of milk that I make and how it's being – but he would choke and cough and do all of that too with feeding. But I was just like, oh, maybe that's just my milk, you know, my letdown.
I know it is. It's hard to tell. I mean, it's true. Sometimes babies who even have a perfect mouth, if you have a really fast letdown – it's hard. It's like a hose.
He had lip and tongue tie, so he probably had something. I would say he had like a maybe mild to moderate, and yeah, outgrew it by like 3 or 4 months. Because I remember it was around 3 or 4 months that we went into lactation consultant, and she's like, yeah, the reflux will probably be peaking now and then get better. Because I was like, this is not good. And then it kind of got better, and now he's almost 6 months. So yeah, interesting.
Okay, yeah. And so then for Sunday, I feel like for her, it peaked around – there was a couple of different peaks. One of them for sure was around 9 weeks. I remember that. And then, because she was just dropping off her growth curve, like every time I went in, it was just lower and lower and lower. And I was so stressed out about that. I think it also, there was a peak around 4 months. We really finally noticed a big change in turnaround in the less spit up and more kind of consistent weight gain around 8 or 9 months for her, which is longer than, you know, it's double the length of like a normal case. It was just all very unfortunate the way that it all went down, but it's like she was okay. I was so happy that she never had any. I never ever felt actually worried about her breathing.
Yeah.
It just wasn't that vibe. It was more like, you're okay. You just need to, we just need to get the milk to stay in your body so that you can grow and gain weight. You know, it's interesting. Okay. And now a word from our sponsor. As we're talking about birth and postpartum support, I want to share my favorite reproductive health nutrition brand, Needed. Pregnancy and postpartum are the most nutritionally demanding phases of a woman's life. Many women will stop their prenatal after birth, but we actually recommend continuing it for at least the first 9 months postpartum and longer if you're breastfeeding. Needed's prenatal multivitamin is the most robust formula I've ever seen, and it contains the bioavailable nutrients you need in evidence-based dosages, which are well above the bare minimums that most prenatals settle for. Their quality standards are also top tier with transparent sourcing and rigorous third-party testing. And that is why now over 6,000 practitioners recommend Needed. Now also we have the results from their IRB approved clinical study, which confirms what we see clinically, that women who take the Needed prenatal multi had significantly higher blood levels of nutrients critical for postpartum and beyond, including vitamin D, B6, B12, riboflavin, K2, and selenium. Only women in the Needed group reached the sufficient levels of vitamin D, which plays a big role in immune health, energy, and mood regulation, all so important during the postpartum season. So while there are many ways to support yourself postpartum, continuing your prenatal is one of the simplest, most impactful and ways to do it, and Needed makes it easy. So learn more at thisisneeded.com/thrive to see more about the study, and use code HEALTHYMOTHER for 20% off of your first order. Yes, healthy mother, as a little mantra or affirmation for yourself. It's so cool. Okay, now back to the show. So what is the treatment for laryngeal malacia? Well, for the 95 or, you know, for the vast majority of cases, you're not going to do anything, and they will grow out of it by age two. So if it's very severe and they think that there's a need for surgery, sometimes they do go on to do that. I have read up a little bit about that, and it seems like there is – it's kind of maybe like one of those other surgeries, you know, maybe a back pain surgery where it – for many patients, it doesn't actually change anything about their symptoms or their experience. In certain cases, maybe some minimal improvement, but it's not a common thing done, and it doesn't seem to be like a huge benefit in a lot of situations. So then, you know, there's the little lifestyle things you do. Like, you keep them upright during feeds and after feeds. You keep them upright during sleep as much as you can. So like, I wore her for every single nap she ever took until she was 4 months old. And then I started to try to put her in the crib for naps. And it was like, there was no way on earth that she could ever nap in the crib. But she would do okay at night. She never spit up at night. And honestly, I always thought about that, and I was like, one day I'm going to figure out why, and I have no idea why. If I would try to put her in her crib during the daytime, I mean, obviously, you know, she was feeding less at in those nighttime hours than in the daytime hours, so potentially it was literally just a stomach fullness thing. I don't know, because she would be sleeping on her belly in her crib at night or in the bassinet thing next to me, and she was noisy and she would wake up all the time, but she never would spit up in her crib. It was crazy. But during the daytime, forget it. There's no way. Like, she would spit up. She'd just soak the sheets. So I always wore her in the carrier. Okay, then there's like feeding adjustments. So you can like feed them slower. If you do have a fast letdown, you lay on your back or you let down into a cup or a pump of some kind, and then you latch them so that it's less like that. Or if you're bottle feeding, sometimes people will thicken the feeds, thicken the milk with one of those like medical liquid thickeners. Basically, it's just – it's pretty benign, but – to make the milk thicker so that it's not so thin, so that they eat it a little bit slower, they get a little bit less air, they can swallow it better, it's less chance to aspirate, etc. Smaller, more frequent meals. And then with managing the reflux, so we did play around with some of these medications. The one that helped the most was just over-the-counter simethicone. Simethicone is a Tiny Remedies, is that the brand that makes the stuff?
So.
Yeah, so Tiny Remedies makes one, and, you know, so it's like less dyes and different things, but it's still a pharmaceutical drug. And it basically helps to disperse air bubbles so that they're smaller, and then they don't affect the child in terms of a burp or gas way to cause discomfort. And on top of how poor she slept anyways, because she was so noisy and then like uncomfortable with all of the air that she had swallowed all day long, the simethicone really helped. So we did that for months at night, not during the daytime, but at night. I would give her a half dose. I figured out from playing around with it, from experimenting, that she didn't need a full dose to get relief. So I would give her a half of a dose of simethicone in the little syringe before bed. And we did that for probably 2 months, maybe even three. And it was so helpful from probably like 2 months to 5 months, like somewhere in that range when it was the worst. And we also at one point tried famotidine, which is one of those like proton – or no, it's not a proton pump inhibitor. It's an H2 blocker, and it did nothing, but I was hopeful. I decided to try it for a whole month. I was very uncomfortable with the idea in general of going on something like that because there is negative effects, but I felt like for her, if it does make a big change and it helps her gain weight, then that was going to be more of a benefit than – the negatives, and I would deal with sort of like the microbiome impacts later. Unfortunately, literally zero change. And so I was bummed out by that, but I was also like, well, whatever, it's easy to come off. So we just stopped after 1 month of that, and nothing, there was no side effects. And then we had to just sort of like continue to help her with her body work. So a huge thing with these kids, often, like I was mentioning, is their oral functioning is not great. And so they often need some sort of exercises that you're doing to help strengthen the muscles, the tongue, the lips. This can be like with a myofunctional therapist or an occupational therapist. In my situation, my craniosacral therapist knew a lot of things. And we have our friend Stephanie, who came and did some occupational therapy things for her too. A lot of overlap between the two different sets of exercises. So I was doing that. I was using the Ninny pacifier, which we can link. It's a really great pacifier for breastfed babies because they have to latch onto it in the way that they latch onto a breast. And for babies who are tongue and lip tied or they have these kinds of oral laxities, it can be almost like a therapy tool because it's hard. Like it was not easy for her to keep it in her mouth. And even if she just would keep it in her mouth for like 5 seconds, it was a tool I would use during the time that I was like doing her exercises inside of her mouth with my finger. And I would try to get her to latch onto it and like slowly let go of my hand and see if she could just keep it in for 5 seconds, you know? And then eventually, I remember one time when she got to the 1 minute mark of being able to keep it in her mouth for 1 minute, I texted the lactation consultant lady I was talking about. I was like, huge win. Like it was a huge celebration. And for her, she would always latch onto it best if she was in the carrier and I was kind of like walking and rocking and bouncing her. One reason I felt very lucky through this whole thing was this, that she didn't cry a lot. She wasn't like a very upset baby. Or if she did, I'm not remembering that, but she's always been really happy and she's always been really sweet. And it was just like this thing that she's dealing with that sucks and that no one can do anything about and nothing seems to help. But like we did keep her really regular with body work. So she would get maybe one to two times a month chiropractic and then like weekly craniosacral therapy. That was the bigger one that was most helpful because it was addressing a lot of different other things in fascia. She was very tense and tight. You know, all my babies are, they're midline defect babies with being tongue and lip tied. So anyway, I do think that there is something to be said as part of your treatment plan to get a really good craniosacral therapist on board to be helping and managing all of this. Ideally, the perfect unicorn situation is that your lactation consultant is also the craniosacral therapist, because then they're intersecting and blending both areas of expertise and how one impacts the other. Trying to think, what else did I do? Oh, one of the things that she wanted me to do as part of the therapy was to get her on a bottle once a day. Literally, I had never tried. Well, my son took bottles all the time because we were in school. And he just, I don't know, I had to give him a bottle like in his first week of life because of his weight gain issues, because of the undiagnosed lip and tongue tie. So I think because he had them so frequently and from early on, he always had the skill. And then all three of my girls have never successfully taken a bottle ever. But I also didn't push it that super hard, except for with Sunday. With Sunday, I tried so hard. I can really fully say that I gave it the best effort that I had possible. And there was no way that that chick was understanding of what was going into her mouth. She like didn't even, it was like this milk was just dribbling down. There was no instinct or reflex to suck on and latch onto it. And I tried all kinds of different bottles and all these different things because that would have been a helpful therapy for her to improve her suck and to like really have to pull milk because we were going to put on like a preemie nipple tip and she's going to have to like actually suck it out. So that didn't work. And then I think like the big main thing for me that I would suggest as somebody who's going through this is if your kid's in the mild world, it probably won't affect things that much. And it's like, okay, you'll just get through. But if you're in a situation where it's like really affecting your sleep and feeding, which when you have a newborn is literally all they do. So all day long it is affected and all day long is hard and all day long feels like chaos, is to kind of, I mean, I think it helped for me was to try to like try these things. So like I had her on a different homeopathic, which is called NatFos. It's a cell salt, actually, NatFos 6X. And that can be a really good one for reflux in some infants. Literally did nothing for Sunday. I had her on colic tinctures, like herbal tinctures, which normally I don't love to give herbs to little babies that are under 6 months that aren't eating solids yet. But in her case, it was like more beneficial than any kind of risk of like, you know, her gut's not ready for herbs, like whatever. So did nothing. Like I tried these different things. And then I just had to come up with that time period of saying, nothing's working. Nothing's helping besides the body work. Like that was kind of something I had in the background that was just scheduled, but I'm not going to try anything else. I'm just going to live my life and like focus on my joy each day. So whether that was going on a walk with my dog, reading the books, taking a bath, like getting, you know, an hour of alone time, even just like back in our bedroom and being able to just hand her off to my husband and change my clothes and be in something clean for once, you know, things like that, like little things. Yeah, little things. And just knowing that this is temporary and knowing that at some point I would get through this, even though every day felt like 100 hours long, it was like, this is not going to be my life forever. And now looking back, of course, I do remember some of it, but I don't remember it at all like I thought I would. Like when you're living in those really hard moment-to-moment time periods of your life, like for you, I know it's pregnancy, it feels like there's no way I could ever forget this. And you just sort of do. I don't know. I mean, you can probably connect to some pieces of your pregnancy journey, right? But it's probably not as severe as it was when you were going through it.
Yeah. And then it's like you have this cute baby who's so sweet and you're like, oh, like I would do that for you again. Yeah. But in the moment being like, I'm suicidal and I will never, ever, ever get pregnant again, you know, yeah. Like just knowing how like the extremes of like, oh, it wasn't that bad. I mean, even looking back on my infertility journey, I'm like, was it that bad? But in the moment, it's like, yes, I was literally crying myself to sleep every night. It was the worst thing ever for 6 years, you know, but you just, yeah, the body forget sometimes. And then sometimes it holds on to something like with my sexual trauma. And it's like, why can't you just forget that?
Yeah, like, interesting.
Stop holding on to this. This is like 1,000 years ago. Like, what is the deal? So yeah, there's certain things I think that the body remembers and certain things that it forgets. And it's very funny.
Yeah. I guess too, you're right. Like now you have this thing that like is so positive that came out of that scenario of this like adorable baby that you're obsessed with that it's just kind of all a blur in the background. The one thing else I will say is that I don't actually know that much information about how laryngeal malacia can affect kids with solids. I can just tell you from my experience that of my other three children, she was extremely delayed in her ability to swallow solids. So she was interested in them. She would put them in her mouth. She would chew them up and then she'd spit them out. And she did not start swallowing actual real food to any kind of level that was like, oh, wow, like her poop is changing until she was like 11 months old, maybe 12 months old. And then she did not eat enough, like where my other kids were at 12 months old. Sunday wasn't like that until 16 months old. So she was like 4 months delayed in her ability to like really intake and process. She didn't gag more. She didn't choke more. Like there was nothing in that kind of regard. I think maybe it was partially because of the lack of tone of her lips and tongue, which obviously over time improved, but potentially there was something there. Maybe her gag reflex was really anterior, although I don't remember her gagging like almost ever, you know, I mean, beyond the just normal a few times here and there. I don't know. She just wouldn't. So I was like really her only nutrition source until 16 months old. And then it was like, okay, now I can start to wean. So then I started to wean at that point, which all my other kids I had fully weaned at 16 months old. So it was just like a really interesting different path. And there was a little bit of like worry I had or I felt this like sense of pressure with that like she is not eating well enough that if I were gone or if I died, I mean, you know, knock on wood, but like she would not be okay. Like she was eating so much milk still that it wasn't like she could just figure it out. Even like packets, even like smoothie, you know, liquid things. She just didn't really show the interest and she just would not swallow. She would not stay focused on them long enough. Like, you know, anyway, so now she is amazing and she's 18 months old. So, I mean, in a very short period of time, she is completely like she eats everything. She eats a lot. She poops like 8 times a day. It's really annoying. Well, no, she either poops a million times a day or she's constipated. There's two forms of Sunday's poop, but either way. So that's kind of like all I have to offer. I just wanted to share my story and then some actual medical things about the diagnosis too, because it does feel like there's a lot of cases happening and there's not that much support around it or even just normalization. But I think my big main takeaway is just that there's not that much you can do about it. They will grow out of it. It can just be kind of a long, trying, hard process. So you sort of have to figure out how you will mentally get by and get around it and know also that even if they do have slow weight gain, it's not going to be something that's going to affect them for the rest of their lives. It's just this infancy thing. And we have these standards and we have these growth curves. And a lot of it's just like numbers and data. And I would often question that whole process during it. I was like, does this even matter? Like, there are people all over the world who have no access to these like measurements. And does it even matter? And I'm causing myself so much stress of the fact that she's like dropped 5% off the growth curve again now this week. Like, what is actually, she has chunky thighs. Like, how is she off the growth curve, but she's fat? Like,
yeah.
You know what I mean? But I do think it's important to kind of keep some of this stuff in check to make sure that they're not failure to thrive, to make sure they're hitting their milestones. And in fact, actually, Sunday has reached all of her milestones the fastest of all of my four children. She crawled at 5 months, like Cade. Mm-hmm. Actually, Cade started crawling like before 5 months old, which is kind of crazy.
I know. He's really fast on everything. Teeth, crawling.
Yes, his teeth too. That was crazy. So I expected her teeth to come in later for some reason, just because other things orally were delayed, but they didn't. They came in right at 6 months like my other kids. She speaks like – she started speaking at 10 months. She started – you know, has just been blabbing ever since. Like all of that kind of stuff was really helpful for me. So I would encourage other moms to look at the whole picture of your whole child. Like, are they doing okay? You know, what is happening? Oh, okay. One thing I did forget in terms of a treatment that's helpful and then we can go is tummy time. Now, this is a double-edged sword because when you put a child on their tummy who has a belly full of milk and who already has reflux problems and spit up problems, they're probably going to spit up a lot. And it's true. So I had to figure out my pattern where she would wake up from sleep and I would put her on her belly. She wanted to feed though. She'd wake up from sleep and she was hungry, but I would do like 10 minutes of tummy time first. And I'm talking like a month old, like young, okay? Yeah. And get on the ground with her and play with her and whatever. Because when you are helping to strengthen the entire anterior, like the front of their body, so front of your body is anterior, back of your body is posterior. When you are strengthening your whole anterior chain of your body, you are strengthening their mouth, their throat, their abs, their core, their diaphragm. All of these things are going to help with the process of this reflux and lack of spitting up, but then also there's kind of, you know, it's sort of a theory, but because all the connective tissue is connected, that if we're strengthening all of that, maybe it's going to help with this epiglottal arch integrity as well. So tummy time, I think, is a very, very big, important piece of therapy for these kids. I think it's important for all infants, but like specifically, and even though you feel like you might be contributing to them spitting up more, just get into a pattern where you do it before their feed or something like that, because it was huge for her. And I think she spent so much time in tummy time that is why she was an early crawler.
Yeah.
Because she just had so much opportunity to get strong. So anyway, okay. I hope that helps. This, I'm sure I'm missing certain pieces because it's, you know, kind of after the fact now, but we do also have two episodes of postpartum updates from me around the time when she was, you know, 0 to 6 months old and it was really bad, where I do talk about it, that we'll link in the show notes, where you can hear a little bit more about just like my personal story. It's not really about laryngeal malacia in this kind of a medical sense, but I think that might find some help in hearing the story from somebody else if you are dealing with this right now.
Oh, I love it. Thank you so much for sharing all of your wisdom. And I know your postpartums have been really hard with your kids, but now you have all of this knowledge to share. And my daughter keeps coming in and out of the room. So I think it's time to wrap this up. And thank you so much, Dr. Morgan.
Thank you. Are you pregnant or trying to conceive and looking for reliable, engaging education around how to have a healthy pregnancy and prepare for the future aspects of motherhood to come, like birth, breastfeeding, and postpartum? Well, then look, I've got you. This is exactly the education that you'll receive with my 6-week pregnancy call. You get access to my most comprehensive resource of everything I wish women knew before heading into motherhood. It's simultaneously a pregnancy health course, birth prep series, breastfeeding 101 course, and postpartum planning class all in one. And now it's available not only during our live rounds, where you get tons of one-on-one support from me and a small group of like-minded women, but also in a lessons-only format. The lessons-only version of this course is just that. It's all of the content, but it's without the Q&A calls and without the group chat. This version is available on my website at all times, too. So log on to www.milkmedicine.com/lessons-only to check it out, or you can go to the show notes for the link. I hope that you'll enjoy it. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Healthy as a Mother podcast. In order for others to hear this information, please leave a review with Apple Podcasts, subscribe, and send to a friend who could benefit from this content. We're so excited to share more on becoming and being a mother next time.
And please remember that the ideas and views of this podcast are for informational purposes only and are not intended to serve as a substitute for medical care of any kind, including the diagnosis or treatment of any illness or disease. Consult with your provider before integrating this information into your own care plan. And remember, a healthier future starts now, and it starts with you.